So did you get your samples?
We're live. I'm going to push this over to the other side so we can talk without being recorded.
Okay.
Hello there.
Hi.
Hi. Hi, hello.
Hello? Hi,
yes.
Tom Wheelwright calling.
I'm sorry, this is
Tom Wheelwright.
Tom Wheelwright?
Yes.
How
are you,
sir? Tom?
Good, how are you?
Okay. Tom, we're ready to go if you are.
Tom, this is Dan Perkins.
I'm the co-host,
and I'll be asking you some questions. Fascinated to hear what your take is, and we're looking forward to the interview. So are you ready to go, Don?
I am. Just got 5 seconds
okay.
of silence. Our next guest is here to tell us about a subject that's concerning us all, especially here in the small business area. As everybody knows, the Senate and the House have each passed new tax plans. They now have to reconcile them. We have author and CPA Tom Wheelwright here to talk about the potential tax plan impacts on small business and what might be happening in the congressional conferences. Tom, welcome to the program.
Great. Thanks very much. Great to be on the program.
Tom, tell us first a little bit about your background, which is fairly unique, and before we get into anything else.
Well, I've been in Washington, D.C. the last time we had major tax reform, 1986, with the National Tax Office of Ernst & Young. And that was fascinating back then. I've also been an adjunct professor at ASU for 14 years. Run my own CPA firm for 25 years and wrote Tax Your Wealth. Mostly what I do is educate entrepreneurs, small businesses like our listeners here, on how to permanently reduce their taxes.
Well, that's really terrific. Your website, before we go any further?
It is taxfreewealthadvisor.com, taxfreewealthadvisor.com. Thank you.
Can you spell it out for our audience?
I can. It's tax, T-A-X, free, F-R-E-E, wealth, W-E-A-L-T-H, advisor, A-D-V-I-S-O-R.com.
Well, from here on in, I'm going to turn you over to Dan, because this is an area that he knows well and you know well. So go to it, Dan.
Thank you. And good morning, Tom. Thank you for joining us today.
Good morning. So great to be with you.
Yeah. We have two competing bills, House and Senate. Some elements of similarity and some great divergences between the two processes. I think the first question that I would like to ask you, do you think we're going to get a bill?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Everybody wants the corporate tax reform. Nobody's arguing about that. I mean, frankly, if the Democrats were included, they'd probably even vote for the corporate tax reform. It's the rest of it that's, I think, challenging for people, particularly the individual provisions. But in order to pay for the corporate tax reform, you've got to raise the money somewhere.
Tom, I write commentary for a lot of blogs, and I recently wrote a commentary about the tax bill and have been dismayed at the logic or lack thereof in both houses. Both seem to be driven by a static model of revenue neutral, driven by an evaluation done by the Congressional Budget Office. Our economy is anything but static. In fact, you may have seen yesterday where the president says that he thinks it's possible to achieve a 6% growth in GDP. Now, 2 weeks ago, Goldman put out a review for 2018, and they think it's possible that it could be 4% or a little higher, numbers we haven't seen in a long, long time. I often wonder why we use a revenue neutral bias when one of the alternatives is to cut the budget. So I'm still dismayed that we have both houses. Nobody seems to be talking about, I know that's a broad statement, nobody, but do you think there's a possibility that what might come out of this is some budget reductions?
It's interesting. Actually, I was just reading this morning. I know that's on Paul Ryan's list, the budget reduction. And I know that it's quite a bit separate from the tax bill. I don't think it'll be part of the tax bill. You know, the neutrality of tax bills goes way back into the 80s when the Senate passed they passed legislation that said that any tax bill had to be revenue neutral. So it's really a function that they decided long ago that they were going to do revenue neutral, and they haven't changed that and probably won't.
But the concern that I have, Tom, is that excuse me, if you look at our budgets are in deficit. We've got $20 trillion of outstanding debt. Where's the revenue neutral there? Where is the offset? Where is the it didn't happen.
Exactly.
So, you know.
No, it's absolutely true, and that's what happens when you have different rules for different things. So we have, you know, it's like the 1986 Act was revenue neutral, and yet the 1986 Act caused the real estate crisis of 1989, which was caused huge federal deficits. So you can say the bill itself was revenue neutral, but the effects certainly weren't revenue neutral.
Right. So what do you see out of the two branches, the House and the Senate? What do you see? And then I have a very specific question for myself as a small businessman that I know affects a lot of other small businessmen. What do you see that will be positive for small business out of looking at both bills and likely to survive?
Well, I think there's a lot of positive in both bills for small business. I mean, certainly the expensing of all equipment is positive. The reduction in the depreciation lives for real estate is very positive. A lot of small businesses own real estate. That's a huge positive. You know, they eliminated like-kind exchanges, the 1031 exchange for a lot of people, but like for ranchers, for example, they're eliminated, but for real estate, they maintained it. They maintained the carried interest rule as long as you have it for 3 years. For, you know, small businesses that are starting a business, that can be a very important provision. And then even though we're not getting parity, you know, small businesses we think of as being flow-through, because most of us are, and, you know, we go, well, there's not parity with the corporate reduction, and that's true. It's still a reduction, so we're still getting a tax reduction. So that is still positive. Well, you know, people can argue all day long, is it fair? The question is it positive? It's absolutely positive because it's a reduction either on the Senate side in a deduction or on the House side in a lower rate. So I think there's a huge amount of positives for small business in this bill.
Let me ask you a very specific question that I know affects everybody like myself and Don who are LLCs and or partnerships,
right,
or whatever that is, flow through. I don't know the exact term, but I can tell you what I call it. There appears to be a tax penalty, which I have to pay for being a small business, and it can be quite expensive. It's a supplemental tax that I have to pay because I am a small business, and in my case, I'm a single employee small business. And you know, it costs thousands and thousands of dollars in this tax. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Which provision are you talking about? You're talking about the effect on of the flow-through rates? Are you talking about the net investment income tax? Which provision are you referring to?
There is an item on my 1041 or 1040, whatever it is, where I have to pay an additional tax because I'm a small business.
You're talking about the Medicare tax.
Nope. There's another tax. There's too many taxes. I wish I could be more articulate for you, but last year it was over $10,000. It's because I'm self-employed or I have a pass-through entity, I have to pay an additional tax. And I don't know whether that's an additional Social Security tax?
There is that. Well, sure. I mean, if you're organized as a general partnership or you're organized as a sole proprietor, you pay Social Security tax on 100% of the income from your business. Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Yep.
But there are ways
to deal with that. I mean, there are ways to avoid that. So, but you're right. That is there.
So I'm paying a tax, and I'm wondering if I could say this right. When I pay my quarterly taxes, my estimated quarterly taxes, and I'm paying it to the General Treasury, I'm assuming that a portion of that is the Social Security taxes that I would have to pay as an individual.
Absolutely.
And I'm wondering the corporation, my LLC, is also assessed the employer half of the Social Security taxes.
You do. You pay both sides because you're both the employer and the employee. So you are paying both sides of that tax. Absolutely.
Okay. So that's probably what the tax is I'm talking about. It's my corporate Social Security tax. So it's in a sense, is it fair to say in that situation, Tom, that my LLC is not a true pass-through because the LLC has a tax liability because it is an LLC?
Well, no, it is a true pass-through. So in other words, whether you were an LLC or you were a sole proprietor, you would pay the same amount of Social Security tax. So, you're paying all of it. Okay, the LLC pays no tax. You're paying all of it. But you're paying both the employer side and the employee side. So it's really flow through. I mean, it's like extra super duper flow through. You get double tax.
Okay, so let's deal with right now. It's what advice are you giving your clients that they should or shouldn't do between now and the end of the year while we're waiting for this bill to come out?
Well, you know, there are some things that are retroactive, and there are some things that, because they're not retroactive, effectively you have some opportunities. So, for example, if you live on the coasts and you've got a state income, an estimated tax payment for your state due in January, you're going to want to make that now because that's not going to be deductible likely if you make it in January. Same with property taxes. You know, if you can pay your March property tax, okay, or your May property tax now, you're probably going to be better off. So there's that. And then some of the expensing provisions of the new bill come into effect this year, 2017. So if you've been thinking about large capital expenditures anyway, and you're thinking about, should I make them, you know, you can make them now and get the tax benefit in 2017. You don't have to wait until the tax bill, you know, until next year, you know, to get those benefits. So there are things that you can do. The other thing that you ought to really be looking at is, because the corporate rate comes down to 20%, I think every small business has to look at, should we now be not a pass-through? Should we now be a corporation? Should we tax as a corporation because they're so low? If we're not taking all of the money out of our business, if we're reinvesting a lot of the money into our business because we're growing the business, there's a whole new incentive now to be a C corporation, a tax corporation, instead of a flow through.
But if I'm a small business and I use this, the small business provides most of my income, so then I'm draining a lot of the money out of the corporation. Then if I went to a C corporation, wouldn't I have double taxation on some of that revenue coming out?
You would. What the tax bill, particularly the House bill, does is it effectively brings corporations and flow-throughs to the same tax level if you're at the highest rate. So if you're at a 39.6% rate individually in a flow-through, you would pay 39.6%, but there's 30% of that under the House bill that would be taxed at a 25% rate, which effectively brings you to a 32% rate. If you were to be a corporation, you would pay 20%, but then you would pay an additional 15 to 20% on the 80% that you distribute, and you end up at a 32% rate too. So you actually end up with parity between the two. So you're right. If you distribute most of your income, you're probably still better off being a flow through.
Yeah. It seems to me that looking at the provisions in both sets of bills, you said some of the provisions are retroactive. Are there a couple of things that you can tell our audience that you think you got to do this or don't do that? Something that they can look at their business. I mean, you talked about the changing in the depreciation schedule for both real estate and the expensing of plant and equipment. Is that retroactive or is that going to affect next year?
It is. Well, the depreciation, I believe, goes into effect next year, but the expensing increases go into effect this year. So I think there are a couple of things. I mean, for one thing, make your state estimated tax payment in December, okay? That's an absolute must. You must make it this year because you may not even get it next year. It's not just timing this time. Another thing that really you ought to be looking at is, you know, a lot of businesses wonder, should I own real estate? Well, if you ever were wondering, this would be a time that you would really add in the tax consequences to that because they can be significant to owning your building instead of renting your building. A lot of tax benefits in real estate in this bill. So that's another thing I'd be looking at for sure.
One of the things that we should talk a little bit about is how our pension plans affected, if any, by the law?
You know, they're really not. I mean, we thought they were going to be. It looked like they were going to affect 401k plans and that they were going to have some restrictions there. And the one thing that they're doing is, and here's something that you might want to consider, is that they are going to restrict the rollover from a regular IRA to a Roth IRA. So if you're considering that, this is something you ought to sit down with your tax advisor before the end of the year and say, look, should we be looking at this rollover this year instead of waiting, because that rollover is going away in both bills.
So there will be no provision to roll from a regular IRA to a Roth, assuming that the bills pass in going forward in 2018?
That's correct.
Wow. So that's off the table.
It is.
Any other surprises?
I actually think there's going to be a lot of surprises. The Senate bill is a very odd bill because it's got a lot of details in it. So you really need to look at your industry. I mean, for example, there's special rules for citrus growers. There's special rules for beer importers. There's all sorts of special rules in the Senate bill. So, you know, you got to look at your industry. Make sure you talk to your industry, you know, your industry association and find out what's in there, because if you're in one of those industries that's affected, it can be a real plus for you. So I don't think the surprises are going to be necessarily negative. I think some of the surprises people are going to find are going to be positives, because there are some tax benefits in that bill that you can tell that what happened was is that Senator Hatch went to each senator and said, what will it take for you to sign off on this bill? And they got little provisions in there. And, you know, they have to – it's the Senate that's driving this, not the House, because the House has the votes no matter what. The Senate needs every single vote.
Yeah. So how do you feel about Ms. Pelosi's description of the tax bill being Armageddon and we're all going to die?
Well, this is the same person who said, let's pass Obamacare first and then we'll read it.
Yes. We don't know what's in it until after we pass it.
Exactly.
Unbelievable.
We're not going to know what's in it until after we pass it. Now we know what's in it. And, you know, one thing that's interesting is eliminating that individual mandate. And the question is whether they'll do anything about the employer mandate, which it doesn't look like they will. So that's another little thing that people haven't been talking about, is that while you're no longer mandated as an individual to buy insurance, as an employer, if you have over 50 employees, you're still mandated in offering insurance.
Wow. I wasn't aware of that. There's a provision in going back to retirement plans. There's a provision if you are covered by a SEP IRA, especially if you're a small business, single entrepreneur, there's a provision that allows you to set up, I think the current number is like $53,000 up to 25% of your adjusted gross or pre-tax income up to $53,000, which is a huge, huge benefit for a small business that has a SEP IRA. Is that going to stay or is that going to disappear?
Everything I've seen, that's staying. So
wow.
The same's true with solo 401k has the same provision in it. Everything I've seen says it's going to stay.
Is the 401k as generous as the SEP IRA at $53,000?
It is. The solo 401k and the SEP IRA work the same.
Okay.
Dan, let me jump in here a moment ask our guest to tell us his website again, because I'm getting all sorts of calls that they want to. Tom Wheelwright, tell us your website again.
It is taxfreewealthadvisor.com, taxfreewealthadvisor.com, and it's named after my book, Tax Free Wealth. So if you really want to understand the tax law, Tax Free Wealth, I made it really simple, and it's available everywhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, et cetera.
Well, I've been fascinated by this conversation, so I'm going to turn it right back to you, Dan.
Thank you. Tom, I wanted to move on to the political problem, if that's I'm not sure that that's the right way to address it, but clearly the tax, as I understand the tax bill, if you live on the coast in New York, New Jersey, California, Massachusetts, very high tax states, there's going to be either elimination of the tax deduction for state income tax or a significant reduction or a cap. Is that going to go through?
For sure. One thing they're looking at, though, is they're going to cap it at $10,000. Whether that means capping it to only be property tax or being a choice of property tax or income tax or sales tax, we don't know that, but it looks for sure that they're going to cap it at $10,000.
Now, there's a discussion about increasing the standard deduction, doubling the standard deduction. And
right.
Some people feel that their analysis is that by increasing the standard deduction, you may take a lot of people who might have been able to deduct mortgage interest or real estate taxes or state taxes, and by doubling the itemized or doubling the standard deduction, you're going to pick up a number of people who will still benefit from the doubling of the standard exemption.
Yeah, that's for sure.
They're going to gain something of what they lose.
They are. Now, what people seem to miss is that they also lose their personal exemptions. So if you have, if you have kids under 18, that's made up with the tax credit. But losing those personal exemptions in some cases is going to mean that even though your standard deduction has doubled, you may still end up with a tax increase because of losing the personal exemptions.
Okay. So, I think it's, as I recall, I live in Florida. There is no state income tax, but there is property
right.
tax in the state of Florida. We, unlike where Don lives in New Jersey, who has state and maybe even local income tax in addition to federal, plus some of the highest real estate tax rates in the country, those key centers of high taxation, are they going to be really adversely affected by this? I mean, significantly adversely affected or not?
You know, it's possible. I think probably less than people think. And for one reason is that a lot of those people are losing their state tax deduction through the alternative minimum tax now anyway. So because you don't get it for alternative minimum tax purposes, right? So a lot of those people that, you know, get big because they have big state taxes because they're making decent money in their small business, you know, they're losing that benefit anyway. So I don't think it's as big as people might think it is. I actually think that the mortgage interest deduction will have a major effect on the coast because you're going to see a little bit of pressure on property prices when you reduce the mortgage interest deduction down to a $500,000 cap.
Wow! So that the tax revenue to the states won't be affected. It's just the deductibility of the tax from the federal purposes, right?
Right. I mean, the argument is that a low tax state like Florida, a no tax state like Florida, or a low tax state like Arizona, where I am, effectively we're subsidizing those states, okay, because of the state tax deduction. That's the argument. So you're right. I mean, the states themselves aren't affected, but the voters sure are, for sure.
Well, then can I jump in here and ask Tom a question? I'm in New Jersey, and we have the highest property taxes in the nation per capita. And the only way local and state government has really to finance schools is by the property tax. But it, and the headlines have been from last week that doomsday is upon us because this these bills will affect affect them. If I heard you correct, you're saying it will probably just reduce the upward desirability price of homes. But I would think it would have to start politicians to reassess how they raise money. Am I right or wrong?
Oh, I think that it might. Now, property taxes, you know, when typically when we get a bond election, we're told that, well, you just have to reduce how much you eat at McDonald's once a week, right? You know, or once a month or something like that. It's not that big a number. I think that what the concern is that if you put pressure on the prices, remember, the value of those homes is driving the amount of property tax. And so if the value of those homes goes down, the property tax collected goes down. And I think that's a bigger concern, okay, than the actual deduction of the property tax.
No, it's all Greek to me, to quote Shakespeare.
Yeah.
But if I could ask one question, on the whole, do you think the small business has benefited from this change, or remained the same, or been hurt by these changes? In your opinion,
there's no question. There's tremendous benefits to small business in both of these bills. Through expensing of equipment, through the real estate depreciation deduction, through the reduction in the flow through tax rate, through the corporate tax rate, because a lot of small businesses are taxed as corporations. You know, there's a provision that if you're just starting a small business, there's a provision that if you start it as a corporation, as a C corporation, a taxable corporation, and you sell it after 5 years, there's no tax on the gain. So that's a huge benefit to small business that typically, because of the lack of flowing through the losses in the early years and the high tax rate, the 35% tax rate, when startups have gone, well, no, we're going to start as a flow-through, like a partnership or an S corporation. We're going to start as a flow-through. Then eventually we may have to be a corporation. But with this new bill, you know, with this new, these new provisions, that's a huge benefit. If you're doing a, if you're starting a small business and you're thinking, boy, in 5, 6, 7 years, I'm going to sell this thing, you could actually completely avoid the gain by doing that.
Dan, you get to ask the last question.
Oh, darn, only one. So following what you were just saying there, Tom, if I were an LLC, would I be better off to reincorporate as a C corporation?
You might be. You might be, and it's really easy to make the change. In fact, under the law, they're making it really, really easy to make the change. They're putting some transition rules in. They're really trying to make it easy to change to that C corporation under both bills. So I think you'll find that you'll do the analysis, sit down with your advisor, do the analysis, make sure it makes sense for you in the long run. And then I'm going to reassess every single client and look at, should we be a C corporation, at least for some of the businesses.
Yeah, because if you're right, if I could switch from an LLC, I'm thinking about a client of mine who is currently set up as an LLC, and I wanted to make sure I understood what you said. If you hold it for, would you say 5 years?
Right.
If you hold it for 5 years and you sell the business, there's no capital gains tax at the business level, but the shareholders would have their own individual tax.
No. There's no capital gains at the shareholder level. No capital gains.
Whoa.
Okay? So you can't convert. You've got to start as now there's some planning you can do to, you know, like you say, if you're small enough, you can probably just start new, right? But if you start as a corporation, not an LLC, but and now it can be an LLC taxed as a corporation, okay? So you can do that. But if you start as a corporation, then the gains when you sell your stock are not subject to capital gains tax if you hold it for 5 years.
Wow. That was worth the call alone.
There you go.
Tom, is it that for companies going forward or for companies backwards as well?
You know, that provision's been in there for a long time, okay? So this is not – that's not what's new. What's new is now there's an additional incentive because we've got such low corporate tax rates. Now you have to say, look, we know that when we start a business, we're going to have losses for the first year or two. We like to use those losses to offset income from our wages, right? But let's say our spouse is not starting a business and he or she has wages, and we'd like to use those losses and get that tax benefit now, which you lose in a corporation. But the long-term benefit now is so good with a 20% tax rate, and then if you do sell, you get no capital gains. I think there's going to be – I mean, I'm certainly going to encourage more of my clients to set up as a C corporation.
Yeah, good idea.
Oh, we're talking with Tom Wheelwright, he's a CPA and author, about the differences in the House Senate versions of the tax bill. We're going to invite Tom back as soon as the bills are reconciled to tell us what's in it. Don't you agree, Dan?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I would love to do that.
Please do. Let's stay in touch. And thank you. And tell us once again your website.
It is Tax-Free Wealth, like the book, TaxFreeWealthAdvisor.com, TaxFreeWealthAdvisor.com.
Tom, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Hey, Tom, please have your PR person stay in touch. In a minute it passes, we're going to have you on the program.
For sure. Be happy to. That was great.
Okay.
Thanks very much. Terrific interview. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Dan, I'm waiting for our next guest. He's I'm checking now why not on.
Okay. And what's the guest after that?
I'm sorry?
We have another guest after him?
We're supposed to, yes. Both are supposed to be on. Let me see what's happened, Tom. Yeah, Kyle.
I don't have him or her. All I had was Tom. I've got Curtis Spar.
Yeah.
And that's all I had.
Well, we got one coming. It's coming at 10:50. Oh my God, 10:55 a.m.
Right?
No, 11:22. No, that's one. Hold on a second. That's the one. And then Eva. Here's Eva. I guess Kyle's not coming on. Well, we don't have him. We got somebody at 11:22. I'm sorry.
Who's it?
He didn't come
to.
The one that's on the thing. Let me look.
Curtis
yeah, Bosker. Yeah, Spar. Yes.
Okay.
He's the one with
11:20.
Harassment, yes.
Okay.
I guess Kyle didn't show up. I can't.
Doesn't appear.
Hello.
Hi there. Hello there. Are you there?
Yes.
How you
Hello?
Doing?
Can you hear me? I'm doing well.
Okay. Is this hold on a second. I want to make sure is Bosfar Curtis Spar?
My name is Curtis Sparer, and the company is named Bospar.
Right. He's joining us to talk about sexual harassment. Correct?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Okay. Dan, you're
yes.
on. Curtis Sparer. Curtis, how do you pronounce your last name? I'm not hearing it because of these headphones.
Of course, Sparer.
Sparrow. Okay.
Sparer. Curtis Sparer. It's
okay.
It's a tricky one to pronounce.
Are you ready
to
go?
I'm ready as I'll ever be. Sparrow, not Sparrow.
Sparrow.
Yes.
Sparrow.
Correct.
Okay. 5 seconds silence. In perhaps one of the hottest topics of the day, BOSPAR Principal Curtis Sparrow has joined us to talk about sexual harassment in the workplace. A link to his website will be on Recalculating Biz tonight. But first, we want to talk to Curtis about sexual harassment and what it means, particularly in relation to small business. Curtis, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Curtis, first tell us a little bit about yourself and what BOSPAR does before we do anything else.
Okay. I'm the principal of BOSPAR. It's a PR agency with offices in San Francisco, Chicago, New York, and Washington, and L.A. And we help tech companies articulate their story and explain it, because sometimes the technology is so far out there that it's difficult for the rest of us to understand, and so we help them figure it out. And what we did is we did research about what sort of, responses the American public get when they hear people apologize for sexual harassment or for any crisis in the workplace. And what we discovered is that a lot of people take a sort of suspicious view when they hear stuff like the accusations are untrue or from the bottom of my heart, or when someone blames a conspiracy, or, and I know everyone has heard this one before, especially when someone blames fake news.
Well, we have a lot to talk about. I'm going to first start and let Dan begin. I have a lot of questions, but I'm sure Dan does as well.
So, good morning, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Sure. I have written a number. I write for about 8 different blogs, and I've written some commentary on this issue that you're talking about. And, you know, I'm going to give you 3 examples. Charlie Rose, Matt Lauer, and our esteemed senator from the state of Minnesota, I like to call him Stuart Smalley from his Saturday Night Live days. When these 3 men and some others came out after they were accused of their activities, I was actually quite angry at what was going on. Angry about several things, but it seemed to me that all 3 men and many others all start out with the same words, and those words that they were embarrassed. Now, the first words were not about any apology to the women that they may have abused. They were embarrassed. They didn't say what they were embarrassed about, whether they were embarrassed that they got caught or whether they were embarrassed in their activities. But they apparently were not embarrassed up until the day before they were caught and outed. I thought it was like somebody had sent out a script. Here's what you say. The first thing you say is, I'm embarrassed. I mean, how does Charlie Rose say that he's embarrassed when he's accused of parading around in his birthday suit or a robe on that's open and people coming into his home? He's embarrassed. And it just seems to me terribly, terribly inappropriate the way to begin. And so then I agree with what you're saying, and that is, this highly suspect of how sincere their apology when it eventually comes is.
Yeah,
I think
in any apology, you need to first show remorse to the hurt party. So I agree that taking on the case of embarrassment and making that the very first flag you want to fly shows that you're still thinking about yourself and not who you wronged. And so that's why I think there is a kind of a moral upchuck when people hear that sort of priorities in an apology. First you say you're sorry to the victim, and then you could talk about yourself. But I think if I was a politician, I would first apologize to the person harmed, then I'd apologize to my constituents, and then maybe I would describe a little bit of my reaction to it and how I'm going to make the situation better. And I think the problem that we've had with all of these situations is that they've been very focused on the perpetrator, and we have not really heard how they're going to make the world a better place or what they're going to do differently. They've basically done some form of, I'm ashamed of this, and it's too bad, and that's it. But they've not really done anything to make the situation better for the future for their daughters or their son.
Well, you know, it's, what's interesting to me about what you're saying is that my partner, Mr. Mazzola, said to me in a conversation, the difference between Democrats and Republicans, and I'm trying to quote him as exactly as I can, is that Republicans tend to have relationships with a single woman for many, many years. Democrats seem to go from one to another on a regular basis. They don't have short-term, they don't have long-term relationships with the women that they have sexual relations with. So I don't know whether that's true or not. I just thought it was an interesting insight by my partner, which makes a hell of a lot of sense to me. I wanted to ask you, does your company provide counsel to individuals and or corporations that have employees with these issues?
So what we do is when a company has a crisis, they will come to us and they'll say, we have a crisis, this is what happened. And then what we do is we enact a crisis plan that we have already worked with them to develop, because we believe that the first way of dealing with a crisis is preparing for it well in advance. And so then it's a matter of how we respond. Usually a good crisis plan involves bringing in a third party so that there's someone objective who can be helping out. And then it's a matter of what kind of crisis is it? Is it a HR crisis? Is it a legal crisis? Or is it a technological crisis? And so each crisis is the same in so much as you want to prepare, respond, and recover. But each crisis is different in the sense of the details that manifest.
Yeah, I many, many years ago, and I at the moment I can't tell you how many, but it was a lot. I took a crisis management course at the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, and that course was designed to try and help management of companies to deal with a crisis when it hits. At that particular time, as I said, it was many decades ago. At that particular time, the people that were teaching the course were saying that many corporations have no crisis management. And you look around at what's going on in our business world today, whether it's the hacking of tens of millions of customer files or a number of things, automobiles that have been modified to pass tests and are not reality, and on and on and on. It appears that there are still many, many corporations, even big corporations, who have no crisis management plans, and that they're managing the crisis on the fly. Is that true?
Oh, there are so many people who are managing on the fly. And when they do, we see all sorts of goofy, unforced errors. And so I think that when we have seen examples like with United, for example, or with other companies responding to a crisis, lurching from statement to statement, you get a sense that they're making it up as they go along, and that's a real problem
right.
these days.
So when you see the United or the Volkswagen or the banks or the credit companies having all these problems and you see the responses, do you cringe?
Well, it's more like a moment of Cassandra from the Iliad, where I just raise up my hand and say, why? Why didn't they listen? Because there's always someone who's saying, you know, we really should be preparing for this ahead of time. We really should be thinking, is this a good idea? Or if it's not a good idea, what can we do? And so I think if I was a business owner listening to this right now, my big thought would be, what is our crisis plan? Do we have one? And what can we do to make sure that if a crisis hits us, that we are ready to act and act calmly? I know mm-hmm. that airlines, for example, what their professionals have confided in me, and I'm not going to give any names since it was confided, is that the easiest crisis for them to deal with is a plane crash, because they have a full book that they just go through page after page after page that walks them through mm-hmm. each step methodically. The problem is that most companies don't have such a similar book for other crises that come out, whether they are hacked or whether there is an HR complaint. These companies do not have a detailed plan of attack, and that's what we're saying is needed. And it's clear that in our research with Americans, one of the first things people wanted to do wanted to hear from a company when a problem happened is a explanation within 24 hours that's in simple, easy to understand English. And that's been missing from American corporate life for a long time. You may remember that Uber was recently announced that it was hacked, but it did not come forward with the details until about a year later. And that kind of cover-up is the thing that drives American consumers nuts.
Yeah, we had the same problem with Yahoo. Waited a year to announce a significant breach in their security. Don, go ahead.
Yeah. Curtis, I wanted to bring up something that came out of a focus group we did about a month ago. You know, we're aimed specifically at small business leaders, and we all agree that most small businesses are ill-equipped, but and everybody seems to be now jumping on and saying that women and men victims are always correct, but in the focus group that we had, that two presidents, one was a woman and one was a man, both talked about what they felt were unjustified accusations leveled at managers, because the people were in danger of getting fired. Has your survey talked about that or done anything, or how do you feel about it, or do you want to address it at all?
You know, I think that terminations from issues like this are not something that I could easily put in a one-size-fits-all sort of statement. I do know that when there is a big crisis that's happened, Americans overwhelmingly want someone fired for gross negligence. The question becomes defining gross negligence, and what does it mean? And it's almost kind of that thing where people are like, I can't explain it, but when I see it, I can clearly recognize it. And I think, for example, in the situation of Uber, there was a definite strong feeling of gross negligence in terms of how long it took for the company to reveal it. And I think over a year might be definitely the red line in gross negligence when it comes to alerting customers about breaches of information. So I'm not sure if I can give an exact answer, but that might be the best I can give you.
Well, we're only searching for answers. We try to get as much information. But do you think that harassment is increasing, decreasing, or about the same over the years in your experience?
My suspicion is that the awareness of harassment and what constitutes harassment is increasing. I think that people have finally reached a breaking point in what they will tolerate and what they'll accept. And I think that the situation with the Me Too campaign has really crystallized that. And so I think executives in every company, large and small, are taking a real hard look at how they do business and how their employees do business as well.
Dan, back to you.
Sure. Thank you. I did a piece, as I mentioned to you, on this whole subject matter, and I raised the question as to how that it's going to affect the two things. One, the workplace environment, and two, the relationships between men and women. And I suggested, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, that the demand for sex robots might appreciate dramatically.
You know, I actually work with AI companies, and I can tell you that one of our clients discovered that men would flirt with AIs with female names. And so I went through the records, and it was kind of astonishing just how many guys would begin flirting with robotic women. So I do think you're onto something. I also think one of the things that I see as a small business guy is my company is all virtual. We all work from home. And one thing I've noticed that's different than a physical office is that when you work virtually, the HR complaints of any kind drop dramatically because you don't have a physical space in which to say something wrong or off color or come off the wrong way. And so I suspect more and more companies will go virtual as they try to cut down on the overhead of, having a building space, but also the, relative slings and arrows of HR problems like harassment.
So I would say to you that there have been a lot of studies done about the social isolation of people working independently from home, that there used to be a chemistry by being in the same place with more than one person to synergize ideas and concepts. Much more difficult to do that over the internet and through social media. Not impossible, but perhaps not as productive. Go ahead.
You know, I think that there is an interesting point, and that there have been a lot of different things that companies have done that have had trade-offs. For example, mm-hmm. I came from an open workplace environment, and I promise you, it was nearly impossible to do any critical thinking in a space where everyone was talking around you. And so mm-hmm. I think that as offices evolve, there's always going to be trade-offs. I completely understand what you're saying about the social isolation, but that's why we've been using video conferencing, for example, as a way of getting around that. And mm-hmm. so I find that by doing that and by also having regular meetups, that isolation really, that feeling of isolation is really diminished because you have your time at work, even if it's in your home office, is punctuated with a lot of activity.
So let me move on to another facet of this issue. I'm going to make another observation, and you can tell me whether I'm crazy or not. We've already talked about how the interpersonal relationship between men and women might change regardless of the workforce. But in the workforce, I wonder, I'm just wondering out loud with you, is it possible that this issue actually turns out to be more detrimental to women than they're thinking? Will the male leadership in corporations today change their demeanor and their interaction with women that may restrict their promotion ability?
I would think not. I think that I think we're really at a turning point where we are in a stone's throw of gender equality, and I don't think any male executive would want to risk being seen as a caveman by undermining the career of women for fear of what could happen in the future. So I would suspect that what's going to be happening is that things are rapidly going to move to gender equality within the United States. And I think the laggards are going to be viewed as kind of like the Saudi Arabias of the world.
Okay, let me give you another statistic. I have a foundation that deals with wounded soldiers and veterans suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, sleep deprivation, and working in suicide prevention.
Mm-hmm.
The Veterans Department of Veterans Affairs, a year ago, October, for the first time in the history of the VA, began to release data based on sex. The suicide rate for male veterans, is four times the civilian population.
Mm-hmm.
The suicide rate for female veterans is 12 times the suicide rate for their sisters in civilian life. Over 55% of women veterans said they were sexually harassed at least one time during their active duty service. And there are estimated 600,000 out of 2.1 million women veterans who are diagnosed, probably more, with post-traumatic stress disorder. When interviewed why such a high level of sexual harassment, many of the women responded that they felt that the male soldier in a combat situation would not have confidence that the female soldier would have his back. That does she have the strength, if I'm wounded, to pull me out of a bunker? And so much of the harassment was a function of life and death on the part of soldiers in a combat situation. So here we have our military that has what some could construe a huge problem of a bias against women, and a huge percentage of the women have said that they were harassed while they were on active duty. How do we turn that one?
Well, that's just so beyond my pay grade at the moment. I'm not sure how I could give a succinct answer. I can say this, that I believe that it was the absolute right thing to do to desegregate the armed forces and have troops serve together regardless of their ethnic background. And I believe it's still the right thing to do to have men and women serve together and alongside each other. I think that people, regardless of gender, definitely have differences where sometimes there are women who I think would be stronger and better suited for a job than a man. And so I would say that my kind of guiding hope is that we play to our strengths, whether it's a military force or a small, medium-sized company or a big enterprise, and we give opportunity for all, but that we also reward excellence and support it. And I know that's kind of a whiffy answer because it's kind of like I'm having the whole thing. And in many ways it is. But I definitely think that companies and organizations that aim for diversity have been shown to perform better than those organizations that seem to slant one way or the other.
Do you think that the magnitude of the public sexual harassment reports in Hollywood and the news media and the political party, is that going to have a fundamental change on those people that have to go to an office to work?
I think that there is a strong change that is already underway because of what happened with Weinstein and others. I mean, you're seeing a level of awareness within Hollywood that is unheard of. And one thing that I think is underplayed or not played up enough in the popular media is how this is actually going on not just with the Harvey Weinsteins of the world, but also the Kevin Spaceys and the Bryan Singers of the world as well, where whether or not there are truth to these allegations, there is concerns about the image of propriety. And so I would say that there is, first of all, there is nearly no tolerance for even the kind of perhaps perception of impropriety. I think that sort of relaxed atmosphere is gone. I also think that this shows that men in power in general, whether they are gay or straight, tend to behave in certain ways, or at least are tempted to behave in certain ways. So I wouldn't say this is merely a male-female dynamic. I think it's really what happens with men in general. And so I think that there is something about our DNA, our primordial makeup, that creates the temptation for this sort of behavior. And so I do want to say that I think this is beyond a man versus woman thing and more like a what is man made of and how do they develop as they go up their corporate ladder.
So it sounds like you're saying, believe it or not, folks, there is a difference between men and women.
I am saying that there is a difference between men and women, absolutely. And, you know, that just goes from, like, you know, our early days of a species. And I think you would see that along the lines. I do think also, however, that when you consider that the marketplace is, I believe, a majority female, that I think it tends to help companies on either side of the spectrum to make sure that they have a diverse leadership and workforce so that they can be relevant to all sectors of society.
I think I'm right that there are more women employed in the workforce than men now. Is that correct?
That's my belief as well. I think that there are also more women college graduates these days.
Don, I think he wants to ask a question.
I hate to break in. It's been such a fascinating conversation. But Curtis, will you tell us your website again and how people can reach you?
Absolutely. Our website is bospar.com. That is B as in boy, O as in octopus, S as in Sam, P as in Peter, A as in apple, R as in Robert.com. And if you go to our website, you can read all the ways in which we recommend people deal with various corporate and business issues as well as PR issues. And should you want to, you know, bring us on to help, you know, contact success@bosbar.com, and we'll be happy to reach out to you and figure something out.
Thank you
Thank
so
you
much
for
being
us
with
today.
Us. A link to your website will be on Recalculating Biz tonight. And by the way, for listeners, if you want to hear this or any other of our broadcasts, just go to recalculating.biz, and they're all there for you to hear. Thank you, Curtis.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Dan, we got another guest today, someone that I'm really interested to hear from, Othamar Gamma. He's joining us. Othamar, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Don. I'm glad to be here. Nice to meet you.
Othamar, tell us about your company
sure.
What you do and how you help small business.
Yes, we are. Our company is Talentify, and we make recruitment. We put recruitment on autopilot. So our company develops technology that helps business to hire people faster and easier, and without the worrying on managing 12 different types of technologies at once.
Well, and your website?
Yes, our website is talentifyhr.com, which is talentifyhr.com.
Tell us how you got into this business, because that's, I think, a fascinating story.
Yes, I started as a recruiter. I had my own recruitment company. And I grew that company. I ended up having 50 recruiters working with me. We started on the RPO business, which is recruitment process outsourcing. But I always saw how manual and how work task intensive was the recruitment process. And we always thought of ways of how to make our company be able to be more competitive against big recruitment corporations out there. So a few years ago, we started working on technology. I brought some very smart technology people to become our partners. And we made the switch from being a service company to a technology company. And just this year, we released our first product to the mainstream public, our Flux recruitment automation platform. And we were very blessed in having got our first financing round, so we just raised some money from amazing investors and entrepreneurs, and we've been getting a lot of traction. So even though we are able to work with companies different size, from small to large corporations, we have got some large corporations interested in working with our automation process.
Well, Dan, this is a starting point. I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you. So, do you have a niche that you specialize in?
Yes, we are specializing on hourly workers, so retail sales associates, security guards, restaurant workers. So that's our niche.
So you would not be a competitor of the search engines or employment services that are looking to find professionals for you to fill out your corporation. These are hourly workers. So what kind of companies have come to you?
Yeah, so we have worked with a small farm, like an apple farm company from Massachusetts, that they have one retail store in Boston, Red Apple. And they needed people, retail sales and a retail manager, to large companies like Saks Fifth Avenue and Lord & Taylor that need to hire thousands and thousands of seasonal workers for their stores. So those are the types of companies we usually work with.
So how, before you got into this business of offering this service, how were these companies acquiring the transient or seasonal employees? How did they get them?
Yes, that's where we think we can add a lot of efficiency. So they would sometimes work with staffing companies, multiple staffing companies that they have to manage. So a larger company would have to work with multiple staffing companies, and smaller companies would probably just be posting jobs on Craigslist and just being inundated by hundreds of resumes that they don't really know how to screen. So that's the old ways of doing this. So with our platform, a large company, they don't have to go through recruitment or multiple vendors to find people. The platform reads your jobs from your ATS, from what big companies use to post their jobs, and automatically starts looking for those candidates, screens those candidates, ranks those candidates, and then we automatically send people to be interviewed by the store managers. So they don't even have to read a resume. So our platform will read that resume for them, identify who are the best candidates, and send them directly to the stores to be interviewed by the managers.
Do you charge the employee or the employer a fee?
The employer. So we usually charge the employer per interview that we schedule for them.
And if you have a good hire rate, in other words, you're bringing them people that they can hire, are there any additional bonus payments to you for productivity?
Not right now, but that's a great idea.
I won't charge you for that one. You can have that one for free.
Thank you.
So one of the things that we know, sort of, we believe based on the Bureau of Labor Statistics that the unemployment rate is falling.
Yeah.
Yet the same Bureau of Labor Statistics reports about 93 million people out of the workforce. Mm-hmm. So some of us, like myself included, question the unemployment rate, and as a result, there may be a lot more people out there who would be willing to work if there were jobs. We had a revision to third quarter GDP to about 3.3 to 3.4, and now they're saying it might be 3.6 for the year. Goldman is saying that they think it'll be over 4% next year. Trump said yesterday he thinks it could get as high as 6%. So a significant demand for people. Where do you see the greatest need for the kind of people that you have right now?
Yeah, so right now, like, what our clients have been struggling the most are for technical and skilled labor, for example, HVAC or AC installer and repairer, people that they are really like losing a lot of time and losing employees, just searching for those type of employees right now. So people that have some type of trade skills, those are being very hard to hire, constructions and mechanical, automotive. So those are very hard to hire right now for our clients.
And do they pay well?
We couldn't really say that if they pay well. Like, they are having to pay better now if they want to be competitive, they want to attract those people. But we couldn't say, like, well, they need to get there, and some are getting there in order to remain competitive.
Are there any particular areas of the country that are more short people than others?
Yes, we see like areas like California. It's very hard to find people. Seattle, it's very hard to find people. So the western coast it seems to have a greater shortage of skills. And also, like, we see a lot of difficulties in finding those people on smaller cities, on, let's say, Boise, Idaho, cities like that. I don't know if it's just the population, but, like, it's been very hard finding people for those smaller cities as well.
So are you saying by inference that the shortage is more west than it is east, north, or south?
Yeah, we see it much more difficult for our clients to get candidates west, out of west, than we see on south and east. Yeah.
So, would it be fair to assume from your analysis that the old Horace Greeley axiom, go west, young man, or young woman now, the greater opportunity if you have some kind of a skill is in the west?
I think it is there's a lot of opportunities. I wouldn't know, because of, like, the cost of living being high, if that those opportunities would be good opportunities. But I do know that what I can say is that companies are struggling to find those people there. But that might be an issue with, like, pay, other than, like, but this is a actual, like, some areas do have harder time finding people than others. So I think one tip for someone that is looking for a job is to think nationwide, not just on your particular location, if you really are struggling to find a job.
The go ahead, Don.
No. I was going to finish your question. I wanted to jump in afterwards and ask a question.
Okay. Just came across my desk that Al Franken resigned today. I'm thinking in terms of opportunity. We have an economy that is very cyclical in nature, and we're now in a cycle where baby boomers are retiring at the rate of about 10,000 a day, and they will do that for probably number 15-16 years. So areas that have increasing demand for people are some professions: teachers, doctors, nurses, high demand, and some areas of the country that are physically growing are actually paying a bounty to get a teacher to come into their community and take a job. I don't know whether you've seen that before, but I'm wondering if there's such a shortage in the West, if we're going to see that happen, that corporations are going to have to start to pay up in order to get people to fill those jobs. Because if they don't fill the jobs, it's going to have an impact on their ability to grow and prosper as a company.
Exactly. And I have seen that. I have seen, like, even jobs that we wouldn't think as a job that would be hard to fill. But for, let's say, a large rent-a-car company and wanting to hire, like, a sales associate for their San Francisco airport, right? They were offering $2,000 bounty for someone that just like what you would never expect to see retail and very entry level retail job to get a bounty, like to get like some bounty like that. But yeah, we have seen it. Truck drivers, some companies offer $5,000 just to join in. So that's happening already.
Okay, Don, your turn.
I guess I was going to jump in. I hated to break up such a great stream of questions, but I was curious. What have been some of the one or two major obstacles you had in starting and running your business over the years?
Yes, we had to surpass a lot of obstacles on our journey here. Like, one of them was finding a great technology partner, because I am not the technology partner, and I've tried many times hiring people, outsourcing it to, someone. So if someone out there is thinking of starting a technology company, just know you can't start a technology company without having a technology partner with you, like someone that really owns the company with you. So that was my first struggle getting there. And first, it's like you don't have to be, we're set back a couple of years because we were too perfectionist. Like we're really trying to get the product right. And then after like delaying releases many months, when we got to the market, then everyone quotes that Mike Tyson quote, like when you can prepare, but like when all the preparation is done, when you get the first punch on your face. So that's what we seen to us. Like we prepared a lot, tried to come to the market with the best possible product. And then the market tells us, oh, you have to change a lot. So that was something that I think being agile and iterating and just releasing what we have. I think Reid Hoffman from LinkedIn said, if you are not embarrassed by your first release, you took too long to launch it. So I think that was another, and also financing, like finding investors. I think if you are, you can of course bootstrap, and we did bootstrap for a long time. But when you try to go up market, like as we were working with just small businesses, and then we wanted to work with big enterprises, and so many things that I never thought someone would care about, like having the software in scroll in case you go, and then it now makes a lot of sense. So raising your first round, it's essential to go up market and start working with large corporations. And a lot of things you don't expect, like bureaucratic things that make sense for large corporations that I didn't expect. So this would be like the top three things that we have to learn and overcome over the past few years to get to a point where we are now seeing growth and traction.
I have just one more question, Dan, which is if you had to give some advice to small businesses, what would be the two or three things you would tell them?
Yes, I think like one of the things that I've learned on our journey here is like to prepare, to always think and prepare and act like you are already a bigger company. So having your finances right, having like a process and policies right. It seems like when you are starting that we'll never worry about that. But if you want to get somewhere like want to be bigger than you are right now, I think like prepare and act like you were already the size of the company that you want to. And also sales. I think sales have like hustle, like try to put your product out there. That's the only way like you're going to learn and always be iterating. I think those are the two things that if we took too long to learn that we should be out there, we should be talking to clients. And we should be acting like a bigger company. And then once we started doing that, things started to happen to us.
Back to you, Dan.
So following up your comments, it sounded as if you were saying that your thinking was too small to start out with and overly detailed. And you were missing because of the minutia of detail, you were missing the big picture, and you finally realized that you had to act like a big company. Is that fair?
I think it would be two things. One, with our internal governance, yes, we needed to act like a bigger company. And with our product was the opposite. Like we were trying to be too perfect when for the product, like we needed to be more like to be messier and just get it out there. So those are the two things. For your product, for what you sell, like you have to be a bit embarrassed of it and you have to get it out there. Because if you work on a vacuum, if you work only what you have on your mind, only on what you think the client needs, once you get out there, you're going to realize that you were wrong. Everyone and every other CEO that I talk to, everyone says the same thing. Like once you go to market, that's when you really learn. So be messier and be faster when trying to sell your product, and be better and be more precise and have better governance internally. I think if you do the two things, you're going to be able to attract investors. You're going to be acting in a way that they expect their investment to the investment to act, and it will be better for you in the long run.
Yeah. So when did you decide when did you decide you actually needed Salesforce?
After like I saw myself doing everything, like, and then like I was taking too long to reply to a client. I was, or I was trying to sell and not really doing our financings properly, and so I think was when you see like you first. Every CEO has to be the believer of its product, so you have to be out there selling. But once you get the first couple clients, if you either go and raise some money, or you either get the money you're getting for those clients, and you get your first sales leader to work with you, because you can't do it by yourself.
And what was your pitch to your investors? What did you say to them to get them to come along with you?
Basically, I said that what we are doing, because our investor is a strategic investor, so it's a large company in our area, and we basically showed them that what we are doing will disrupt their model, so we would be like a future-proofing them. If by working with us, is what we do like doesn't require recruiters. So that's how the investors saw that this is an opportunity that they want to be close to.
Super.
Dan, one more question. Unfortunately, we're getting to the end of our time.
Okay, thank you. So if you look back at your experience of building this new business, is there a particular thing that you think you would have changed? Would have a different,
yes.
Create a different outcome for the company?
Yes, I think like what I would have, like once we decided we wanted to be a B2B company, sell to big business, I should have looked for investments sooner. Like not, because there's a research out there saying like you can either be a king or rich. So trying to be both, it's very hard. So I think like, especially when you're going to target big corporations, you need to have some money to work with. You need to have like be able to play with the big boys. You're going to be prepared for. So I would go and do it sooner than I've done.
Okay. Super. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank
We've
you
been
so much.
Othamar, tell us again your website and how people can reach you.
Yes, our website is talentifyhr.com. That is talentifyhr.com. And you can reach me there or look me up on LinkedIn, Othamar Gamma.
Link to your website will be on www.recalculating.biz tonight. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Dan, Don. It was a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Thank you.